morning. So let us continue today the discussion of the Hamiltonian mechanics in the symplectic geometry picture. So yesterday I introduced a symplectic manifold, which is a pair which consists of the manifold, plus on that manifold there is a special tensor living. So this tensor is a two-form, so it's completely anti-symmetric. It has two indices down, and it's completely anti-symmetric. It must be non-degenerate, meaning that at every point, if I understand omega as a matrix, then this matrix has non-zero eigenvalues. Okay, so that's what it means. And moreover, it's closed, so d omega equals to zero. So you just, you know, postulate, so you equip your manifold with this extra structure, which is this tensor which lives on that manifold everywhere. And so yesterday I've seen also the metric. There's lots of similarities between the metric and the symplectic two-form. The biggest difference is that this guy is completely anti-symmetric. Metric is completely symmetric. Okay, so maybe I'll talk about it today. Okay, so once you define omega, so once you have omega, you can use omega to define Poisson bracket, as we did yesterday. And so simply for any two functions living on my manifold f and g, you define this to be df, which is the exterior derivative. It's a differential of a function, and then dot omega dot dg, or in components if you want, omega alpha beta d alpha f d beta g, where this omega is simply an inverse of small omega. So omega dot small omega is equal to 1. And so this guy is sort of an inverse. It lives in a different space, but that's fine. Okay. So we can define Poisson brackets. And we can also define something which is called a Hamiltonian vector field. Hamiltonian vector field. And so for any function f, you define this to be omega d of f. So now notice the similarity between the Poisson bracket and the Hamiltonian vector field. So basically only the left-hand side of the definition is missing. So dg is missing. So there is no surprise that this is actually, if you write it down, it's like a Poisson bracket. I don't write the first argument. Okay, so I'll just write it in a coordinate. But of course, so every vector field defines my integral curves, right? So I have x of f here and x of f here, and so on. So there'll be a corresponding integral curve, gamma f, and let's say I parameterize it by time tf, okay? So just to remind myself that this is really something which is generated, everything is generated by this function f. So I specify f, and then this gives me this concrete vector field here, and then the concrete integral curves, gamma f, t of f. And so, of course, then you can write down this vector field as it's nothing else like a derivative with respect to the corresponding time along that curve, right? So this is what it is. And so if you want to write it in components, so of course what this is omega alpha beta d beta f. So that would be the components of the field, but I just write d alpha of something. And so now it's a vector field. So these are the components of the vector field, x, f, alpha. Okay. Of course, if you choose a different function g, it will define a new vector field and has nothing to do with this one. So for example, I will have an integral curve like that, which will be gamma g, now tg, and I know that will be x of g. So you know, each function on the phase space defines its own vector field and its own integral curves and so on. And then I would write this guy as d over dt, just remembering that it's time corresponding to my function g. Okay, and we have also seen that you can sort of simplify the expression. So there's this Darboux theorem which says there exists a canonical coordinate, and so basically in these coordinates, omega, alpha, beta takes this special form where you have 0, minus 1, 1, 0, and the blocks like this, and 0 everywhere else. And so in other words, your omega equals to d p j batch d q j sum over j. And you can always do it because omega is closed and non-degenerate. And in these special canonical coordinates, of course, my Poisson bracket takes a very special form. So now I have coordinates qi and pi. So at this point, they have nothing to do with coordinates and momenta, but of course, later on, they will be exactly coordinates and momenta. And so now you have df over dqi, dg over dpi, minus df over dpi, dg over dqi. And that's the canonical Poisson bracket, which you know from your elementary course on mechanics. Okay, so this is just symplectic geometry. Has nothing to do with this mechanics. So now let's actually do the Hamiltonian mechanics. So Hamiltonian mechanics. And let's do a special case where actually the Hamiltonian, which is almost it's almost without loss of generality, but what I'll be doing in this section is that H, the Hamiltonian, doesn't depend explicitly on time. So actually, that's the case when you can apply this symplectic geometry approach. But it's almost every time. So you never have Hamiltonian which is time dependent. Almost never. Yes? Well, what do you mean does it require, right? So you know, mechanics doesn't require a Hamiltonian picture. You can equally do it in Lagrangian picture, but sometimes it's better to use Hamiltonian picture.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think so. I think this is really just, you know, a different description of the same thing, and there should be one-to-one correspondence, basically. Yeah. In the same way as Hamiltonian and Lagrangian picture are sort of equivalent, up to some details. Yeah, so I think so. So, yeah. Okay, so let me again remind you the stage. So we have the configuration space. Again, so we have seen this before. So this is my manifold C, and my motion is described by trajectory from Q0 to QT, and dimension of C equals to N, and the coordinates are Q1 to QN. We have seen this before. So now the phase space the statement is that this is a cotangent bundle on this configuration space. So it's T star of C. So now you add momenta to your description. So dimension of this is 2m, and the coordinates are p1 to pn, and then q1 to qn. So that's your coordinates. So now every point actually consists of specifying where on the manifold, on the configuration manifold, I am, and this will be just the components of the momentum form, one form. Yeah. Yes.
So like when you say this size of in bundles, but you define P with five branches. You have five branches and then you represent this type of
thing. Yeah.
So in this case it's not really on electrical components.
It is. I'll just discuss it. It is. okay, so let's. So now, next step is to actually define so-called Cartan one form, which is an analog of the Lagrange one form, but this is much nicer. So you just define theta to be pj dqj. And of course, it's a form which lives on my manifold. Okay. So again, notice that it has non-trivial components only in q directions. So in general, you would have some other components times dpj, but you don't have those here. So it's only non-trivial in half of the dimension. Okay, so you define this. And so once you have that, this defines natural symplectic structure on T star of C, which of course is my two form omega. So omega, and I just take that S equals to D theta. And if you do that, well, all it does is actually it differentiates this guy and it put a batch product in between them. So it's just D PJ H dqj. Okay. And of course, this is non-degenerate as long as your coordinates q's and p's are independent, right? Which of course you assume that you choose such q's and p's so that they are generalized coordinates, so that they are independent. And of course, obviously, it's closed as well. Because if I apply d on omega, I have d square on theta, which is of course identically equal to zero. So this is close as well. Okay, so this is something which you have naturally on any cotangent bundle, basically. So you always have this. So if you consider a cotangent space, it always has this Cartan one form. It always has this symplectic structure on it.
Mm-hmm. And I would basically say we start with an exact omega, which is obviously closed, but I mean, do we impose some kind of topological constraints at all? Because there might be situations where this does not completely equivalent, right? If you have a mechanical system that never reaches, I don't know, a certain configuration, then this is like a hole in the configuration space,
right. I think, yeah. So maybe then you could define this guy only locally, the theta. Interesting. Subtle thing, think about it. Yeah, it's an interesting point, yeah. So of course, now the dynamics is defined by specifying Hamiltonian H, which is nothing else than some function which lives on my manifold. So this is my manifold T star of C, and it takes points on the phase space and just gives you a number, and that's the Hamiltonian. Okay, so in other words, you have H equals 2 h q1 to qn, and then p1 to pn, as you know it from the standard thing. But here, yeah, I'm considering the case where this is not an explicit function of t. So I don't write t here. I will write it tomorrow. I promise to give you t back tomorrow. But here, let's do this. And as I say, it's almost very general. OK, so now to your question. So actually, Legendre transformation is much worse beast than you might think. And so far, you have been thinking about Legendre transformation, which transforms your Lagrangian to Hamiltonian as something which basically transforms one function on a space to another function on a space. It's not true. Okay, so you know, note that the Legendre transform which maps my Lagrangian to Hamiltonian is actually a map between the tangent space to the cotangent space. Okay, so it actually changes where your things are defined. So you know that identifies that identifies Q dot J, which is of course lives on my tangent bundle, with PJ, which is a one form which lives on my cotangent bundle. Okay, according to your familiar prescription, right? So you have that PJ equals to DL over DQ dot J. And Q dot J equals to DH over DPJ. Okay. And that's your prescription. So this what's hiding here is that basically like a derivative with respect to a vector is actually a form. And you know, a vector is a derivative with respect to a form, if you want. So this is really a transformation between tangent bundle and cotangent bundle. Okay, and so H is takes now the standard form, so H is Q dot J PJ minus L, where you plot Q dot J equals to in terms of PJ and so on, or you can write equivalently L is equal to Q dot J PJ minus H, and again this will be transformation from a function which lives on a tangent bundle to a function which lives on a cotangent bundle. Okay, so maybe the best is picture. So this is what's really happening. So you have, you have your tangent bundle, and then you have your cotangent bundle. And these are connected by this Legendre transformation. So now the points here are described by coordinates and momenta. So let's put, z star. It's a point on the cotangent bundle, consists of qj and pj. Similarly here, I will have point z, which is just qj, qj dot. Okay, so these are the points on the tangent bundle. So what lives here is the Lagrangian, and it takes these points to a real number here. What lives here is a Hamiltonian, which gives you real number, right? Okay. By the way, you can also define this canonical projection. And you get a configuration space here. So then you point at the configuration space is just qi. And similarly, you can kill the momenta and define another canonical projection from the cotangent space. So this is the whole picture what you are doing in mechanics, basically.
Is there a way that we can write the P's and the Q's without indices? I mean, how does the basis look like? Because it's a little bit confusing with this notation, maybe. I mean, PJ is the components of the one form, right? So what is the basis of that one form?
Yeah. So it's a good point. I should know that. Okay, so QJs, they live on a so you have a phase space where you have Qs and Ps. So your form so for example if you have QI and Q dot I, so then you are saying that the point which lives on this velocity phase space, so it's some vector, let's say, so the whole vector which lives on a tangent vector of TC. So now it consists of two things. It consists of a point P, which belongs to that configuration space, which are precisely these QIs. And then it consists of a vector which lives on this this guy here. And the components are qi dot, u dot I. So the whole vector equals to q dot I are the components. And then d over, and now I think it's d over d qi dot, right? It must be that. Qi dot are my components. I think so. I think it's something like this. I think. it's a very good question. I'll think about it, but I think this is what it is. Yeah. It's complete darkness. So now, H, so let me put this up. So once we specify our H, we specify our dynamics, then as any function, it determines the Hamiltonian vector field. So it determines the, and it's called now dynamical. It's a special name because it's associated with this H, but what it is just dynamical Hamiltonian vector field according to prescription of the symplectic geometry. So in other words, x of h is just omega dh, which is nothing else than the Poisson bracket h, and it's usually written d over dt. Well, you don't write this h, you just write d over dt. Okay. And of course, this is equivalent to saying that x of h hook omega is equal to minus dh. Okay, so it's just, you know, one of the Hamiltonian vector fields, but now it's called dynamical because it's the one which really determines your dynamics, associated with the true Hamiltonian, okay? And of course, this, you know, generates so integral curves curves which are described by PJT and QJT, okay? So, any vector field, the corresponding integral curve, so any vector field which generates integral curves, you can write the components of that vector field as dx mu over dt, right? So now my x mu actually consists of q's and p's. So there will be two terms here, dqj over dt, d over dqj plus dpj over dt d over dpj. Okay. So this just tells me, well, I have a vector field which generates my integral curves. Okay, so that's, you know, just that I have integral curves. But at the same time, so let me now use these canonical coordinates. Okay, so let me really use the coordinates. Well, we are using them anyway, where my omega takes the special form. And the Poisson bracket, so this guy here, takes exactly the form d over dqi, d over dpi, and so on. Okay, so I just, so here, I'm just using the fact that I have these canonical coordinates naturally, and then by expressing what the Poisson bracket is, so this is equal to dot h, right? And so using now the explicit expression for the canonical Poisson bracket, this is just dh over dpj, d over dqj, and then minus dh over dqj, d over dpj, where I don't write the other one here. So that'll be here, and it'll be here if you feed it. Okay. So now look at this expression and compare what you have on the left-hand side with what you have on the right-hand side. Okay, so you just see that your evolution is according to Hamilton's equations, right? So you just derived, so this is true if and only if actually q dot j equals to dh over dpj and p dot j equals to minus dh over dqj. So the Hamilton's equations are nothing else than basically saying this dynamical field defines integral curves. Right, so this is your Hamilton's equations. So I showed you yesterday that any Hamiltonian vector field actually preserves the volume of the phase space or the volume of your manifold. So of course this will be in particular true if I take the Hamiltonian vector field generated by H, right? Because this is just another Hamiltonian vector field. Just it is generated by H, not by any other function. So what it means is that of course now the Liouville's theorem for the canonical evolution for the dynamics follows from what we have done yesterday. Okay. So now let us have a look once more on these canonical transformations. So let me use a different definition now. A transformation and again, qj equals to qj. Now I don't allow t. Qi, pi, and pj is pj, qi, and pi. Okay. Now we say it's canonical. So last time I defined it as the one which sort of preserves the form of the Hamilton's equations, which in this language actually corresponds to the fact that my symplectic two form doesn't change, if you want. Okay, so you say it's canonical if it preserves, and you can show this is completely equivalent to what I defined before, the canonical form of omega.
That means that
if omega writes in one coordinate as what I have been writing, dqj,
it must write exactly the same in the new coordinates. So let me just show you that at least in n equal to 1 case, this really is the same thing. Okay, so just to have fun, so take n equal to 1. Interesting. And so I have that omega equals to dp dq. Okay, so this is what I want to have. So now what is this? So big P and big Q are functions of small p and small q. So let me do these differentials explicitly. So dp, what it is dp over d small p, dp, plus dp over d small q, dq. Okay, so this is what it is. This is how you do change of coordinates for a form. You just, you know, look at this thing and you write it in terms of the old ones. So now wedge, and the same thing for q. dq over d small q, dq plus dq over d small p, dp. Okay. So now I have 2 by 2, so I have 4 terms. So for example, I have a term which is dp over d small p. And then, so taking, let's say, this one, the first one, and the first one here. So this is just a number, so I can take it, I can put it here. And then what I have is dp dq. Okay, so that's first. Now let me do second. So plus dp over dq, dq over dp, dq h dp. That's second. And now let me take first and second. So dp over dp, dp wedge. Okay. First and second. Dq over dp, dp wedge dp. And finally, second and first. Dp over dq, dq over dq. dq, dq. Okay. So now we have multiplied everything. So if you look at what is this guy, you have dp wedge dp. So now this has to be antisymmetric. So what is this equal to? Dp wedge dp. It's equal to 0. So this guy is 0. Similarly, I have dq wedge dq. Must be 0 again, right? So this guy is 0. And then what happens? So I have now dp wedge dq, and here I have dq wedge dp. So actually, if I swap these, I will have exactly the same term. But if I swap them, I pick up a minus sign, right? So I have, so I can write this, it's minus. So this is equal to dp over dq, dq over d small q, what is it? This p. Here, and then minus dp over dq, dq over dp, and then dp wedge dq. So now, anybody recognizes what's in the bracket? What is it? The Poisson bracket, right? So this thing is just a Poisson bracket of q and p. If I write it, you know, in coordinates q and p, right? So now, of course, you require that this is equal to dp wedge dq. So you require, so in order this to be canonical, you require that this is equal to 1. This is precisely the condition which you know from standard course for your transformation to be canonical. Okay, so really this definition is the same as what you know.
Okay. So now let us use it, right? So now let's assume that I have two Cartan forms, one in the old coordinates and one in the new coordinates. So having two Cartan one forms. So the first one will be pj dqj. And of course, this gives you omega by just taking d theta, right? So that's in the old coordinates. So now you take a different one, which will be pj and dqj in the new coordinates. But you require that it gives you exactly the same omega, right? So omega equals to d theta tilde, the same omega, right? It's the same form, just expressed in new coordinates. So if I subtract these two, so you have, well, omega minus omega is 0, okay, is equal to d theta minus theta tilde. Okay, so that's definitely true. So how do I satisfy this equation? So you know that this equation will be identically satisfied if I take whatever stands here to be d of something, right? So if you take theta minus theta tilde to be d of something, then I satisfy this equation identically. Okay, so what do you have just proved by this simple argument is that actually there exists a generating function FQP such that PJ DQJ minus PJ DQJ equals to D of F. Just from this definition. So you really show that, you know, any canonical transformation is generated by this. There always, for any canonical transformation, there exists this generating function f, which generates it, right? So I have just shown that. Yes? No, no, J is the, if I have many of them, right? J goes from.
J goes only from 1 to n.
Yeah, 1 to
so
n.
It's not really like an index or a metaphor in that sense, because they go from 1 to 2n.
Yeah. If you want, yes.
Because usually when you see something like this, a lower index, upper index.
So here I'm heavily using the fact that actually I have this cotangent bundle. Yeah. And so if you have the cotangent bundle, you have the projection from the cotangent bundle. And you can say, well, this is my base manifold, and this is my cotangent space. So you can really actually, when you have this projection, when you have cotangent bundle, there is a splitting on Qs and Ps, which is sort of unique, right? So you're using this additional thing that you have a cotangent bundle, you can basically say what this index J is. If you had just a general 2n-dimensional manifold, you wouldn't be able to. But now you have, you know, we are using the fact that we have a cotangent bundle. Something. So now you were asking about these Q and P. So let me do it just more explicitly. So for example, so assume that in a neighborhood root of some Q0 and P0, we can take, so this is precisely the condition where you can use the standard generating function as we are using. We can take Q and
small q as independent coordinates. So the condition for that is that the determinant of this, the Jacobian QQ over D PMQ is non-trivial. Then you can use this standard generating function that we have been using. So then you can take F1 to be just function of QJ and big QJ, which of course you take, you know, you express P in terms of the QJ. So it's F of QJ PI PJ of QI and QI. Okay, so this, I'm just writing more explicitly what we have been knowing before. So let's just take, assume that big Q and small Q are actually independent coordinates in this. So then I can write f as a function of small q and q, which in principle is a function of q and p, but I just evaluate p as a function of q and q. And the condition that you can do this is precisely this one here. Okay. So then f gives. Okay. So I have this u derived. So what is it? So on the left-hand side, I just keep it as it is. So pj dqj minus pj dqj. And I just write down explicitly what df is. But f is now function of q and big q. Okay, so it's equals to df1 over dqj dqj plus df1 over dqj dqj, right? And that's it. This is what it is. So now I compare whatever I have on the left-hand side with whatever I have on the right-hand side. So this thing must be equal to that thing, right? So I have an equation that small pj equals to df1 over dqj. And the other one also must be true. So big pj equals to minus df1 over dqj. So if you look at how we define the generating function previously, if the generating function is independent of time, this is precisely what you get, the conditions. Okay. So the logic is slightly reverse. So first, you actually proved that the generating function must exist by simply this argument d squared equals to 0. You first prove, yes, any canonical transformation is generated by a generating function. There always exists such f that I can do that. And then you're writing down the conditions which this function f actually has to satisfy. Or what gives you the canonical transformation explicitly, if you want. Okay, so let's have some fun, which is Noether's theorem version 3, right? So, okay. So before I do that, so I already mentioned this, but let me just stress that. So know that if I have a Poisson bracket of two things, on one hand, I can understand G as my Hamiltonian, if you want. So there will be a corresponding integral curve generated by G, and there will be corresponding time g. So you can understand this as a change. So this g generates d over d
dg, that's my vector field, but now it is the function f, right? So it tells you how the function f changes along the integral curves generated by g. That's one point of view. On the other hand, of course, because this is anti-symmetric, I can write it as g, as minus g of h, right? Because the Poisson bracket is anti-symmetric. Ah, sure. Sorry for that. Minus g of f. So now I can understand that this is my Hamiltonian, if you want, and it generates the flow. So this will generate minus d over dt of f, and how it acts on a function g. So how the function g actually evolves along the other flow generated by f, right? So that's obvious. Okay, so now a theorem. Okay, version 3. So we had two versions at the very beginning of the course. Noether's theorem. So now I would say beautiful version, but anyway, let's say Hamiltonian version. So, and this goes as follows. So let y be a vector field which lives on your manifold, such that this vector field preserves the Hamiltonian, but also preserves the symplectic structure. Okay, so it doesn't change omega and doesn't change Hamiltonian as you move along this vector field, such that L y of omega equals to 0 and L y of my Hamiltonian equals to 0. So basically, the requirement that it doesn't change the symplectic structure is, you know, it's very general requirement. This is precisely what you mean by Hamiltonian is not changed by whatever the transformation I do. Okay. And the statement is, then, there exists an integral of motion, I. It's an integral motion, so such that di over dt, which is, of course, defined as I of h equals to 0. Okay? So that's, I would say, a beautiful version of the Noether's theorem. So really, I have some kind of symmetry, so I define a special direction along which my Hamiltonian doesn't change, and then I can find corresponding integral of motion. Okay? So let us prove that, and prove as two simple steps. So remember how many things we had to do when we were proving the Noether's theorem, the ugly version, right? The sneaky version doesn't make sense at all, but the ugly version, lots of things we had to do, right? So now proof here. So you know that Ly omega equals to 0, that's your assumption, right? So what is this? Using Cartan's lemma, this y d omega plus d y hook omega, right? So this is your Cartan's lemma. So now, of course, d omega equals to 0 because we have symplectic structure. So we now get that 0 equals to d of something. How do I satisfy this? Exactly. You say that this guy, so people put minus sign. I don't know why. So let's put minus sign. So it's equal to d of I, where I is now a function. So y hook omega is a one form. So to make a one form, I just need a function I. Okay, so locally, at least locally, there exists a function I. So that is, there exists a function I such that my vector field y Okay, and if you look at this, this is y hook omega equals to minus di. Okay, what is that? It's precisely your prescription for a Hamiltonian vector field generated by the corresponding function I, right? So y actually equals to y of I is the Hamiltonian vector field. So actually, if your vector field preserves omega, at least locally, it must be a Hamiltonian vector field. You just showed that. And that means that there exists a function which generates this vector field I. Okay, so that's the first step. Second step, you want to use the other assumption. So Ly of h equals to 0. So what is that? It's equal to do I have wrong signs here? Di equals to, I have a, so what is this equal to is so this equals to dh over d, okay, so this is equal to 0, and this equals to dh over d of t generated y by y, right? So this is what we have been discussing here. But of course, it equals to, using this thing here, it equals to minus di over dt, right? And it's equals to 0. So you are done. So we just showed that along the trajectory, I doesn't change. Right, but just using this thing here. Okay, so you're done. We have these two lines to prove Natta's theorem. No. Does it make sense? So now what is even more beautiful, that this Noether's theorem is actually much more general than the one we formulated the first lecture. And the reason why is that actually now your vector field y lives on the phase space. Okay. Before we said, well, let there be a transformation which preserves my configuration space. I can do rotations, I can do translations, I can do whatever. But what I am allowed to do is actually I'm changing my the configuration space a little bit by rotating it, by translating it, and so on. But this guy, y, lives on the whole phase space. So it's more general. Okay, so note the notion of symmetry here is more general, so it's at the level of phase space, and so it's more general than what you might think. Okay, so now basically you have two options, two possibilities. Okay, so possibility one and possibility two. So projection of y, so you take this canonical projection and you apply it to your vector y, it's either zero. So if you project the vector y, it gives you either zero,
Or it's non-zero and gives you some y, which now, you know, it's non-trivial. So I take my vector field, which lives on the phase space, and now I project it on the configuration space. So does it actually, question is, does it, do I see anything on the configuration space? Or, so that's the case if I see something on the configuration space. And it's precisely the symmetries which you know. So the symmetries which correspond to point transformations, which we discussed in the first lecture, transformations on C on the configuration space. So you have non-trivial delta Q. Okay, and such symmetries are called isometries. You can see these symmetries on a configuration space. It's a rotation, it's a translation, something I do to a configuration space. However, if this actually equals to zero, then you cannot see this. Cannot see the action of the symmetry on the configuration space, right? So this symmetry, it's called dynamical symmetry. Or because you cannot see it, it's called hidden symmetry. Because simply it's hiding from you on the configuration space. There is no such transformation of delta Q which would actually generate this transformation, which would generate this symmetry. Okay? So this is just the terminology. So let's have an example of a dynamical symmetry. And you will study it tomorrow on your tutorial. So let's just have an introduction to this. So example, and something everybody knows. And let's say Kepler problem. Kepler problem. So I have a center of force, which is just given by minus k over r square, and it points in the direction of r. So this is r. Sorry for my handwriting. So now examples of integrals of motion corresponding to standard symmetries. What do you think are the integrals of motion for the Kepler problem? Angular momentum and? And energy, perfect. So you have the standard integrals of motion, you have the energy, and then you have the conserved angular momentum. And of course, this corresponds to isometries. So isometries are that you know, nothing depends on time, so everything is, you know, stationary or static, if you want. So static, and then everything is spherically symmetric, right? And then spherically symmetry. It implies that you have these integrals of motion. However, miraculously, Kepler problem actually has additional integral of motion. And it's called Laplace Runge Lenz vector, and it's written as that. A is P vector cross L vector minus mass of the particle which actually circles around, and then R hat. So this is another, it's a vector of, it's three conserved quantities which you can form a vector. It's called Laplace Lens vector. Who has seen this before? Laplace Lens vector? Ah, very good. So at least somebody doesn't know about this. Okay, so what is the geometrical meaning of this? So you know that, well, motion is on an ellipse. This is an ellipse. First approximation of an ellipse. Okay, so then by prescription is P cross L minus something which is in the direction of R. So, for example, if you draw it like this, oh, this is really horrible ellipse. Okay. Not much better. But anyway, so okay, so let's take this point. So I have a particle which circles around
on this ellipse, and then you can show that P dot L, P cross L, in this thing here, it'll be that vector here. Now, something which is in the direction of R is this thing here. So M K R hat will be that. And then the vector, Runge-Lenz vector, is something which points in that direction. What is the direction of motion? So P cross L. So L is conserved like that. And P cross L is like that. So which direction it circles? This way? P cross L. So L goes this direction. Like that? Like that. OK, very good. Thank you. So similarly, if you take, you know, this point here, for example, then it would have M K R hat here. Then P cross L would be like that. And again, A points this direction. So it's a vector which is conserved along the whole of motion. Similarly here, we'll have this direction here. Anyway, so something. So if you read Feynman's lectures on something, then he basically re-derived this existence of this vector, probably from the scratch. He probably maybe didn't know about the work of Laplace and these people. So maybe, you know, he just plays with geometry and he basically shows that this vector is conserved. Okay. M is the mass of the particle which circles around. Yes. Mm-hmm. So this is an example of a dynamical symmetry. Dynamical symmetry. You will show that in your tutorial. So basically, there is no action on the configuration space. There is no transformation of the configuration space I could ever, you know, find, so that it would produce these integrals of motion. Okay, so it's very, you know, very interesting. So in particular, there is no cyclic coordinate, if you want, which you could do so that you would find these integrals of motion, but it's more general than cyclic coordinate. There's really no symmetry of the configuration space. Okay. In fact, you can sort of derive the existence of A from something really, really crazy, and then you map this problem of Kepler to a problem of a geodesic motion on a sphere which is one dimension higher. Okay, but that's, you know, it's completely crazy. So there's hidden SO4 symmetry. Basically, A acts like another angular momentum which is completely independent. And so you can show that you can map the Kepler's problem onto a problem of motion of free particle on a 3 sphere. Nobody knows why it is. So it's just an observation. You just map one problem to another problem, and then you say, well, in this problem, A is just an additional angular momentum I have. And yeah. But, you know, nobody knows why this is the case. There's still, you know, many papers. So my friend just published a paper on this. So yeah, so it's still ongoing research why this is actually the case. And what it actually means. And nobody knows. So two more remarks. So now you have actually all these integrals of motion. So you have E and L and A. OK. So now how what you can show is that there are some constraints. You can show that A dot L actually equals to 0. And that A square can be written in terms of what you already know. That's M square K square plus 2M E L square. OK. So you get one integral of motion plus 3. So in principle, 7. But there are two constraints. So it's 7 minus 2. 7 minus 2 equals to 5 integrals of motion. OK. Integrals of motion, independent ones.
of motion. Okay. So what it actually means, so how many degrees of freedom in this problem? The motion and spherically symmetric potential. So your coordinates are, for example, r, phi, and theta. So if I use spherical coordinates or x, y, and z. So you have 3 degrees of freedom, and you have 5 integrals of motion. So if you have 2 and -1 integrals of motion, then your motion is called maximally superintegrable. It's the most integrable motion there is to be. Okay, so if you have 2 and -1 integrals of motion, 2 and -1 integrals of motion. And this is precisely the case of the Kepler problem. Nobody knows why. By the way, if it's considered just a motion in a central force, not precisely the one which is given by the Newton's law, then you still have, of course, everything is still static, and everything is still spherically symmetric. So you still have these 4. Okay? But this one no longer exists. This one exists only for the Newton's law or for the Coulomb's law, if you want. Okay, so you know, out of all spherically symmetric potentials, nature seems to prefer the one which is given by the Newton's law. And that actually is more integrable than you would expect. Sorry? I have no idea. It's a good question. I would say it does. But even more interestingly, this works only, this also works in full general relativity. So now this is just Newtonian approximation to general relativity description of my motion in the solar system. So now if you take into account general relativistic corrections, this integral actually survives. Exactly, they don't. but you don't get the full vector; you just get one of them. But still, I think it's very, very interesting. Nobody knows why. Again, so you know, in full general relativity, which is completely nonlinear theory, you get something really, really crazy. And again, the theory is preferred by the fact that there is this additional hidden symmetry present. So, let's say similar symmetry exists for, and not only non-rotating, but also for rotating black holes in full GR. So, okay, I don't have time at all, but anyway. So maybe we can stop, whatever. I have no time. Okay, that's fine. So that's first thing. So I said, maximally superintegrable. So what the hell that means? So maybe I should first explain what I mean integrable. Okay, so let me just make a side note. So definition. So the dynamical system is completely or Liouville integrable if it admits. So you have n degrees of freedom. That means you have n q's and n p's. So if it admits n independent conserved quantities or integrals of motion, let's call them fi, which are some functions of q and p, right?
and integrals of motion fi. So what does it mean that you have an integral motion? It means that h and fi equals to 0. Plus, there's an additional condition on them that are in involution. That means that all of them actually pass on commute mutually. I know this is very analogous to what you do in quantum mechanics. You have observables, right? And then you want to find the maximal whatever, so that the commute, they all simultaneously commute, right? So you want these observables to all have Poisson brackets equal to 0. So that's the definition. So if I can find for a system with n degrees of freedom and integrals of motion that in addition to be independent satisfy fi fj equals to 0, then you have a completely integrable system. And so what is this good for if I actually do that? So of course, naively would say, then I can integrate it, right? This is precisely what happens. So the solution, so if this is true, then the solution of equations of motion actually can be integrated. So it's obtained by quadrature. And that means that, by doing a finite number of algebraic operations and integration. So that's basically what it means, is that in principle, you can write down x equals to something, y equals to something, and that something, at the worst possible case, is an integral, which can be done numerically. Okay, so and this is possible only if, actually, the system is completely integrable. Only if you have sufficient number of symmetries in the system, only if you have sufficient number of integrals of motion. Otherwise, you cannot do it. Yes?
Can you then, in general, write sort of like infinite
number? Yeah, infinite number, but it requires infinite time. And so infinite lifetime, and you don't want to do that. Yeah, I don't know. Yeah. So basically, the statement is, unless this is true, you cannot write down the solution. OK, so that's the statement.
And
is the number of degree of freedom. So now what is highly non-trivial here, which doesn't seem non-trivial, is, of course, in order to integrate my equations of motion, because they are second order, so if you have n degrees of freedom, you need 2n integration constants. Right? So you need 2n integration constants. So now I'm saying to find the full solution, 2n integration constants, you basically need only n constants here. So actually, each integral of motion gives you two constants. Each integral of motion can be applied twice. And that's a highly non-trivial statement. And you will see that many times in gauge theories and so on, that each constraint acts twice and actually gives you, reduces your effective space by two. So not by one dimension, but by two. So each of these integrals of motion can be used twice to actually integrate your equations. Highly non-trivial statement. Okay. So I have minus 5 minutes, so let me start a new chapter. and this is also, I think, so the whole section of integrability and the chaos and Poincaré recurrence formula and so on is something I don't have time to cover. But it's very, very interesting and very, very active, part of classical mechanics still. So people still writing papers on classical mechanics, trying to find completely integrable systems. If you find one, you'll be famous because they're always written in some classical mechanics book that this is your system which is completely integrable, right? Because, of course, not very many systems are integrable. And so if you find one, you won a lottery and, yeah. Okay. So let me just do in 3 minutes. So all this was just the Hamiltonian mechanics recast in a new formulation, but there's something which goes beyond Hamiltonian mechanics, and I just want you to hear the name, and it's called Nambu mechanics. And it was done by Nambu, the Japanese scientist, 1973. What is characteristic for Hamiltonian mechanics is, so first of all, your space, your manifold is even dimensional. So you have QIs and PIs. We have seen that you have a two form, which is the symplectic two form. And of course, because you have a two form, you have the corresponding bracket, F and G, is a binary operation. So it eats binary operation. It eats two functions and give you a new function. And it's directly connected to the fact that omega, which you play with, has two indices. Okay. So finally, the dynamics here is just described by one Hamiltonian, so single function. Okay, by one Hamiltonian, it's enough to specify one Hamiltonian. I know the dynamics, Okay, the question is, why this is sufficient? So maybe nature is not like that, right? Maybe this is not enough. Maybe it's not enough to have one Hamiltonian which completely describes my dynamics. Maybe I need two. Maybe I need three. Also, why the hell I have always two n dimensional manifold? Maybe actually I need three variables, not 2n. And why the hell this is a binary operation? So actually, Nambu, 1973, said, okay, so why 2n space? So for example, I can have maybe, to describe physics, maybe I don't need just QI and PI, but maybe I need some extra variables. So this is just a specific example. So then I'll have 3n. But then you can do much more. You can just add more variables. Maybe to describe my physical state, it's not enough to use Q and P's, but maybe something else. Maybe some internal degrees of freedom or something else, right? And so that's the first question. And second question is, why single Hamiltonian is enough? Single H is enough. Okay. And so to describe Nambu mechanics, which get rid of all these things, of course, in the same way as we started with a symplectic two form, now you can start with a more general form, P form. Okay. So what Nambu did is that he postulated. Okay, no, not a symplectic P form, but of course now what is called Nambu tensor. Nambu P form. Okay, so eta. So in the same way, you require that it's non-degenerate and so on, and moreover, it satisfies something like d of omega equals to 0, but this d now is more complicated. So that you get something like Jacobi identities, you get something like, all the properties of the Poisson brackets, But of course, your Poisson bracket now, because eta has p slots, right? It will eat p functions, right? So now your Poisson bracket is not a binary operation, but it eats p functions. And this is defined to be eta df1 dfp. Well, this is, of course, the inverse of eta in some sense, right? This is what we have done before. Okay. So then the dynamics. So by the way, the dynamics here is just df over dt is f of h, right? So that's my dynamics. So here, the dynamics, of course, it needs. So if I want the dynamics of function f1, I need to know all the other functions. So actually, I have p minus 1 Hamiltonians now. Okay, so you have dynamics dynamics now described by P minus one Hamiltonians.
P minus one Hamiltonians, H1 to HP,
H1 to HP minus one. And then your equation, evolution equation is DF is F H1 HP minus one. So that's your dynamics now. So that's the theory. It's been here since 1973. Thousands of papers are written about this theory. The only drawback of this theory is that it really didn't find any applications. So it's beautiful. It has all the properties of the symplectic geometry, of all the properties of the Hamiltonian picture. So you have Liouville theorem, you have nice Poisson brackets, you have Noether's theorem, you have all these things. But simply, nobody really found any applications. So applications are waiting for you. So applications, it's not entirely true. So applications were actually precisely to superintegrable systems. Superintegrable systems, where you can show that you can take the Hamiltonians systems, where you can take these Hamiltonians to be exactly your integrals of motion. So for example, Kepler problem has a formulation in this number mechanics. You simply take, for example, A, this vector, to be your Hamiltonians, for example. Okay, so that's... but also, in string theory, to brain dynamics. And I don't have to explain anything because you will have an expert on this coming here who will actually be one of the examinators for your essay. So ask him. So Joel Minich wrote papers on brain dynamics formulated in terms of the number mechanics. Okay, so I think it's a big challenge. It's a beautiful mathematical structure waiting for you out. You know, it's known what this thing can do, but simply, you know, is it useful for physics? Is it useful for something? Or is it like string theory and not useful for anything? So let me stop here.
Why can't you just construct those and just...
It's a good question. You can't for some reason. but I'm not an expert. It's a very good question, but I'm not an expert on this. But you can't. You can't. This is more general framework.
Is there really unique time evolution? Because I mean, I could choose any kind of combination of H1
minus one, right? No. So you assume that you have P minus one Hamiltonians which are given to you, right? And so they simply define the dynamics.